UK Wine Show, show number 104. Joe Fattorini on Scottish wine drinkers. On this week's show...
But somebody was looking at the champagne market and they said, who drank the most champagne per head? And London came out tops and they said, well, who drinks the second most? And it was Glasgow.
And in the news, 2005 Bordeaux soars in value, Riverina region produces bumper crop, and Wetherspoons attempt world's biggest wine tasting.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 104 for the 9th of March 2008. This week we have another full-on show and we're talking with Joe Fattorini, wine writer for the Glasgow Herald. We're talking to Joe about Scotland and why a successful wine journalist would put his neck on the line by studying for an MW. We also have the results from our wine poll on bottle sizes and the news. So, let's get straight to the news with our very own Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Well, first up this week is the news that cases of Bordeaux 2005 vintage that were sold on Premier have increased in value more than any other vintage between harvest and being shipped to the UK. According to Berry Brothers and Rudd, some of the wines are now worth over 300% more than they were when they were released 2 years ago. So a 12-bottle case of 2005 Chateau Lafite Rothschild, which was released at £3,300, is now worth a whopping £10,100. Many of these top wines are now unavailable, making them even more valuable, and in the last week alone, Berry Brothers sold 1,700 cases worth £6.8 million, which works out at an average of £4,000 a case. The 2005 vintage was lauded as the most impressive vintage ever, and demand from the Far East and Russia has pushed prices sky high. Most of the 2005 reds won't be ready to drink for at least 10 years. While they're laid down, they're certainly making a good return. On average, Berry Brothers and Rudd say that wine from top quality vintages will see a return in the region of 10 to 15% per annum over 5 years, making wine more profitable than some more conventional investments over the long term. Perhaps we should have bought a case a couple of years ago, Chris.
Maybe we should have. Many people have said that the 2005 was one of the best vintages ever, and of the wines that I've tried of that particular vintage, they are very good. The question for me is, what will happen to the wines afterwards? 2005 has set a high watermark for Bordeaux, great vintage, produced when the world economy was going well. But since then, the next two vintages have not been as good, and the economies have softened considerably, particularly in the UK and US. But the prices have remained as enthusiastically as high as the 2005. Also, when you consider that the pound and the dollar have lost considerable ground against the euro, are the later vintages going to increase in value? Who knows for certain? But certainly, since 2005, Bordeaux sales have slowly moved away from the UK and US to China and Russia. Certainly, these markets have more money to pay for wines, and after all, once you get over about £20 to £50 a bottle, it's not really about the quality of the wine that you're paying for. It's more of a supply-demand thing. So, as long as there's demand, it's unlikely that you'll see a softening in Bordeaux prices, irrespective of the quality produced. And what do you think, Jane? You weren't that keen to buy any wine at that point. Have you changed your mind?
Well, in hindsight, I really wish we had bought a couple of cases because I would certainly have been doing better than our ices and peps that we have. Never mind. Moving on from fine wines of Bordeaux down to mass-produced wines of Riverina in Australia. Our next story is that Riverina, who's the largest wine-producing region in New South Wales, has harvested a record-breaking crop of grapes in spite of Australia's drought conditions and low water availability. Around 301,000 tonnes of grapes were harvested for the 2008 vintage, up 10,000 tonnes on the previous record-breaking year of 2006. And the Riverina Wine Grapes Marketing Board has told us that even though growers were producing lower than average yields, the region had seen a resurgence in terms of production, and they're continuing to plant grapes, principally to service export markets. For those of you who don't know, Riverina is centred on the Murrumbidgee irrigation area and so enjoys a higher allocation of available water than other regions in Australia because it's closer to source. Riverina also had timely rain that increased the tonnage to greater than expected levels. And the grape quality, they say, should be exceptional, as the vines were well nurtured and maintained with no major instances of stress. However, a bigger crop of quality grapes doesn't necessarily mean lots of cheaper wine for the consumer. According to the marketing board, fertilizer, water, fuel and labor costs have all been rising over the past few years, so eventually the price of wine will need to rise to take this into account. And this could pave the way for other low-cost new world producers to still share from the Aussies. Any comments, Chris?
The big grape harvest will be a welcome relief to many Riverina growers who have heard the stories from people saying that global warming will destroy the engine room of Australia's viticulture, and it's not going to be feasible to grow grapes there. By the way, Jane, I've heard there's a Guinness Book of World Record attempt in London for wine tasting that the listeners can get involved in with a free glass of wine. What's going on there?
Yes, my third story is that UK pub chain JD Wetherspoon is inviting customers to take part in the world's largest wine tasting in an attempt to create a new Guinness World Record. The synchronised tasting will take place in all Wetherspoon pubs across the UK at 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 21st of May 2008. Customers will be offered a free 50ml glass of Fetzer Coldwater Creek wine, and more than 5,100 tasters will have the chance to sip at the same time to beat the current world record. The event launches Wetherspoon's 19-day wine festival, which runs until the 8th of June, during which all wines will be sold at house wine prices, including 6 guest wines that have been added to the list.
Any other news stories, Jane?
Nope, that's it from me this week. But don't forget, you can get more details on these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Whoa, that Guinness Book of World Records. I might pop down and help myself, actually, to a nice glass of wine. But next up, we have the poll results in this week's Spotlight. If you recall, the question was, wine is mainly sold in 750ml bottles, but some producers are putting wine into 500ml bottles to share between two. Do you think smaller bottles are a good idea? Well, the poll ran for most of April and a wee bit of May, and the results are this. 40% said, no, I can't see the need for smaller bottles. 6% said, no, I think offering the same wine in different sizes could result in less choice. 34% said, yes, I'd buy them occasionally. And 21% actually said it was brilliant, and they'd probably buy them on a regular basis. Now, that was quite surprising. This poll was run after a number of health groups suggested that sensible bottle size for two people to drink was 500ml, rather than the normal 750ml. The results indicate that the largest group see no use for smaller bottles. However, 55% said they would buy them at least occasionally, if not regularly, which is quite a big group and outnumbers the 40%. For me personally, the biggest issue is the reduction of choice. Would smaller bottles exist alongside the larger bottles, or would a different range of wines exist for smaller bottles? This was not considered an issue by the public, with only 6% of the poll saying that they were worried about it. When we asked the poll in small groups, often in tastings, there was a lot of bravado that the smaller bottles had no use. Some people even said that they would have purchased them occasionally, as they've often found that 750ml bottle was not enough, and they could easily drink two bottles of 500ml between two people instead. Other anecdotal comments were that 500ml bottles was brilliant because a white bottle for her and a red for him would suit a couple better than having to share the same wine over a night. All in all, I don't think that offering smaller bottles will make much difference to consumption. Some will drink more because of it, while others will drink less. I think the last point I'd like to make is that even if all wine is not finished off in one evening, it is possible to leave the remaining wine in the bottle and using a wine preserver. There's lots of them around, such as VacuVin or filling the bottle up with inert gas. There's no real need to change format size if you've got a bit of self-control. The question is, just so you know, we had 270 entries for the poll, and that pretty much ends this week's Spotlight. Next up, we have the interview with Joe Fattorini. Joe has done pretty much every job in the wine trade, except for maybe making it. He's sold wine, educated people on wine, and writes about wine. His current role is wine writer for the Herald in Glasgow. We talked to Joe about wine writing, sitting the MW, and the Scottish wine market. And why is Glasgow the second biggest champagne consumer in the UK? Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm with Joe Fattorini. He is the wine writer for the Herald in Scotland. How are you, Joe?
I'm on sparkling form.
Sparkling
frothing.
Form?
I'm frothing, I tell
frothing. You. You write for the Herald. Wine recommendations. You said earlier that your wine writing style is maybe not your typical wine writer.
Distinctive, I think, yes. It's a product of how I got into wine writing in the first place. I mean, in some ways, I write the same sort of column as everyone else. There's a narrative about wine, and then we have four wines that we recommend at the end. But I was an academic. I was a university lecturer, and I was asked to do some courses on wine for some hotel management students. And there was a guy came in who I thought was a tramp. And it turned out he wasn't a tramp at all. He was a journalist, but they sort of looked similar. And he was a very famous journalist in Scotland, a guy called Tom Shields. And Tom was doing a bizarre sort of degree where he was allowed to just go and sort of cherry pick whatever classes he wanted. It's a terribly long, convoluted story. And he said, do you want to write a couple of columns together? I think he had a tax bill to pay or something. So he said, oh, I'll write these columns. And we wrote together. And he taught me to write, but very much in a diary style. So it wasn't coming into it from a wine writing background at all. And we used to write sort of idiot columns where we pretended to have fights and things about claret. And then we would come up with strange ideas. I remember we once had got hold of some really good Bordeaux, and it was new release Bordeaux. And he said, you know, how should we deal with this? Should we go and you know, I thought we were going to find some group of wine fans to go and try it with. And he said, no, I've got a better group of people. And he took me to a really rough pub in the East End of Glasgow. And it turned out it was where all the men from the Salvation Army Hostel used to hang out. And so we did a new release first growth Bordeaux tasting with members of the Salvation Army Hostel. And we had all these comments from these homeless guys about the wines, and they absolutely adored them. And the best thing was, I mean, Tom said, I bet they'll come up with some good notes. They came up with brilliant tasting notes, and they absolutely adored the wines, and they thought this was the most marvellous thing ever. Of course, you know, half the readers wrote in and said this was an outrage and we should have invited them. But, I like to feel that we're pretty democratic in the Glasgow Herald.
Yeah, even first growth Bordeaux probably tastes a lot better than turpentine.
Absolutely, it certainly does.
I did a tasting for a load of Sun readers just north of Manchester one time, and I gave them, you know, we were tasting 20 quid bottles of wine, and they just didn't like them at all.
Really?
Yeah, it just wasn't what they're used to drinking. And, and it's quite hard sometimes changing.
And it's a fascinating thing, I think, writing a wine column when you really get under the skin of your readers, because there is no one style of reader, and I can guarantee I can go and write about wines and half of them will love them and half of them absolutely hate them. But very often it's that sense that a lot of readers of newspaper columns aren't themselves necessarily enormous wine fans. They quite like reading about wine and so on, but then they're not necessarily chasing enormous complexity. They just want a nice glass of wine on a Friday night. And certainly, you know, in Glasgow, people, they will tell you exactly what they feel. And a lot of the times we write about really good stuff. And I had a letter from a man who was raging, and he'd sent it all back. And it was an outstanding wine. I mean, you know, endless numbers of critics had loved it. But what he wanted was something much simpler, straightforward, fresher style of wine. And so I have to be a bit careful sometimes in what I recommend. Because if you recommend, quotes, really great stuff, a lot of readers don't really like that kind of thing.
We do a top 30. We run wine tastings and we get people to rate the wines. And our number five wine at the moment is actually a 659 Chenin Blanc from South Africa. And it's beating all sorts of really, you know, technically much better wines, but it delivers clean fruit, not complex, but just good, clean wine, and really goes down a treat. And people like it, and they rate it accordingly, which is quite surprising if you compare it to a 30 quid bottle of wine that's brilliant, but people like something else.
This is very much the sort of philosophy, if you like, and it sounds unbelievably sort of arsey to say you have a philosophy of wine writing, because that's not what you've got. But I think we can overestimate how interested people are in wine. And because we're really madly keen on it, but we are sort of peculiar. I mean, we're the weird ones in this general equation.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can also overestimate what it is that people are looking for. Most people, you know, wine is something that engages them, I guess, for about 10 minutes a day. And even then, it's engaging them in the sense of, well, how much am I going to have to pay? And is it going to be kind of all right? And that doesn't, I don't want to sound as though I'm sort of running people down, because I know people can get very much into it, but mostly they don't. And so whenever I've written, I tend to avoid going and writing too much about the complexities of winemaking and so on, the things that really engage with me, because mostly people want to hear a good story. They want to hear an entertaining story. The most successful column I ever wrote, it was about me falling off a bicycle. And the letters we got in, and people absolutely loved it. And when I went in to hospital about 6 months later to have the wire removed, the curtains thrust open, and there was this big Glaswegian doctor who was like, oh, fantastic! And he just loved this column, and apparently he didn't believe I'd actually fallen off the bike. He thought I'd make this whole thing up. And he was there standing laughing
where
at my
arm.
And it was all in my elbow.
Oh, that's right.
And so it was all my elbow was there, and it was in absolute agony. I knew I was going to have to go under general anaesthetic. I got a Scottish doctor laughing his brains off. Oh, it was such a funny column. You falling off your bike, the funniest thing that happened to me all summer. I'm just going, you bastard. You know, it really hurt. But that's the sort of thing that I think engages people often.
Okay. Do you think you're English, mm-hmm. you're writing for a Scottish paper. There is a north-south divide a wee bit.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't want to stereotype things too much. But do you think the Glasgow or Edinburgh or the Scottish consumer is different to maybe the English consumer?
The Scottish consumer is a different consumer. Interestingly, in some ways, they're much better served than many English regions. London has an enormously large number of people selling wine to them. And actually, what I found, and funnily enough, I used to work as a wholesaler in Scotland, and we measured how many wholesalers there were selling largely into the sort of independent and on-trade, the restaurants and hotels. And we found, actually, you get this kind of lag in the north of England. And then when you get to Scotland, you get loads of people, because often what happens is a London company looks to appoint a regional manager somewhere, and the place they choose is Scotland. So they go and put someone in. And we counted, I think it was 53, 54 companies who had people on the ground selling wine into just the independent and wholesale sector. So we often have this enormously broad range of choice. I think what I've found over time is that sometimes means that at the very top end, people are almost grossly overserved. There is this kind of private client market, shooting parties. I mean, you know, sometimes people think of Glasgow and they just think it's a lot of ruffians running around with knives. And there was potentially a time when that wasn't an entirely inaccurate description. It's now a pretty stylish city, but also we tend to forget that around it, there's lots of very wealthy people and there's lots of shooting lodges and there's all of that side to Scotland, which is quite traditional. And in fact, if you want to go and buy really good claret, well, you can go and get some fantastic stuff. So we've got wine merchants like Inverarity Vaults, for instance. Wonderful wine merchant, the most fantastic, broadly old world list, doing brilliant stuff in Scotland, all the way across the sort of central belt and out into the countryside. There is also then this market which it's much like in the rest of the UK. It's very much driven around brands. They're sort of fairly sensitive to price and so on. And they like drinking just like everybody else. The one thing I would possibly see in them is that they historically have drunk more than the rest of the market. And I know that certainly in Scotland, there was this famous story, I think it's apocryphal, but somebody was looking at the champagne market and they said, who drank the most champagne per head? And London came out tops. And they said, well, who drinks the second most? And it was Glasgow. And I'm not entirely certain if this was true, but apparently the sort of general gist of it was. And they then went back and he said, we went back and we looked at the rest of the data. And it turned out that champagne was the one sector where Glasgow really underperformed, because on every other category, they were the biggest drinkers. I don't know if it's absolutely right, but I think there's a certain element of truth to that. People do drink quite heavily in Scotland. It is a social problem. But also, I think for wine merchants, it can make it quite an interesting market, because you can sell quite shishy stuff to a relatively small group of people, and they'll buy quite a bit of it.
There's probably, what, three reasonable-sized cities of affluence, Edinburgh, Scotland, and maybe Aberdeen, particularly with the oil money up there. If you're a wine merchant and you want to sell high-end wine, there's money in Aberdeen.
Interestingly, that sort of high-end wine market, I think, has a certain spread across it, because you get a good market up in the West Coast. I was very lucky. One of my first jobs in the wine trade it was sort of luck and not luck. I was given a sales territory, and I started in the west of Glasgow, which was really rough, and I had Ibrox Football Club was one of my customers. And so I had that, went out into Paisley, which Paisley has some fun areas to go and sell wine into. But then once a week on Thursdays, I was allowed to drive out, and I had Fort William and Oban and places. And there are some really smart restaurants which can do very good volumes of very, very high-end wine all the way up that kind of western coast. Certainly Aberdeen is a great place to go and sell wine. Places like the Orkneys as well, very good kind of holiday trade, often year-round as well. It's not as season as you'd imagine. But mostly, you sell wine in the Central Belt. You know, and most people in Scotland live in this Central Belt.
That's
from Glasgow to Edinburgh.
Glasgow, Edinburgh, yeah.
And there is a distinction between the two markets. I think it is fair to say that Edinburgh is a little bit more traditional. It's a bit more old world. There's this long history of importing claret, and you can buy great claret in Edinburgh. Glasgow, sometimes people have referred to it as the Barcelona of the North. It has no relationship in terms of weather, but certainly there is this sense of a mild kind of independence, a certain resurgence to the economy. It's always said that if you want to go and do a good charity auction, you go and do it in Glasgow because people are a bit more flashy. There's a bit more flash with the cash. And people will often buy Icon wines and New World Icon wines more in Glasgow. But, you know, that's maybe an element of, you know, I wouldn't want to pigeonhole them because in the end when Inverarity, again, these guys with the great old world list, when they wanted to open a shop, where did they go? Well, they went to Glasgow because they reckoned that that was where they were going to be most successful.
Fantastic. Getting back to your wine career, touched on Scotland, it's quite interesting to see how that market's maybe a little bit different. When did you actually start out? You talked about the lecturer got you to write. Was that your first experience? Because obviously they don't get you to teach a course without knowing something.
they don't. It wasn't my first experience. We believe, my parents and I were discussing this about 5 years ago, and we couldn't quite work out why I was into wine. We think, my grandfather's a great collector, and we think that at a party when I was seven, I passed out from drinking too much Latour 45. And it was his last cases and he served it. I don't think I went completely nuts, but apparently I had three or four glasses and that was keeled over, which you would do when you were seven. I was at boarding school and I was caught by my tutor when I was 16 serving drinks out of my tuck box. And I thought I was going to get expelled. I remember I thought, what do you do? You know, you're in your room and you've got a whole lot of guys and we're all going in drinking, I don't know what it was, claret or something. And I said, well, do you want a drink? And he kind of looked at me. He was an army officer, a very sort of upright army officer. And he said, no, thanks very much for offering. And walked away and never mentioned it again. And he said years later, at my 21st, he said, well, you know, to be honest, you were just having a civilized drink. And I thought that I should encourage this kind of behavior. So when I left university, I'd always wanted to be a soldier and the army turned me down. Apparently I'm not disciplined enough. And I went to work for a variety of people. I worked in a very big company. I worked for Threshers. I ran one of their wine rack stores. Yeah. In fact, the guy who had the store opposite me was Jonathan Butt, who is now the buyer for the Thresher Group, and we had opposing stores years ago in Epping in Essex. And then I worked for a very small company, but a very vibrant, dynamic one in Yorkshire Dells, the Wright Wine Company, and got going there. But I had a sort of strange career. I was an academic for 5 years, teaching, amongst other things, wine classes. I then became a radio and TV presenter and did some work going and presenting TV shows, mostly about food, a little bit about wine, but also sort of personal finance and stuff. And at this period, I started writing about wine. But I have an interesting background because I then had far too many children. And my wife,
how many have you got?
I have four. And it is far too many children. It's ridiculous carry-on.
Make sure that we don't listen to the show.
No, they're great fun. They all enjoy Shiraz mostly. And my wife said, well, you are going to have to earn some proper money. And I worked for Matthew Clark, and the UK's largest wine wholesaler. And it was a very interesting background when you've been in the independent and the journalism trade, where you tend to be focused on small producers, independent retailers, excitement, to go and work for a company which is very much focused around going and selling relatively large volumes. And I ran their Scottish wine sales division. And I remember my last year, we turned over my team. I think we did something like £10.5 million worth of wine. And you suddenly realise, you know, you're shuffling this kind of volume of wine out into the market. And it was a real education. And ever since, when I've written about things, I have tended to take the view that much as some people may deride them, Tesco, Yellowtail, Matthew Clark, Constellation actually provide a need to the market, supply a need in the market, and are very, very good at it. Yeah. And it is if wine writing sometimes has a failure, is it's too quick to sort of knock what it's a little bit of that kind of, you know, 18.5 million people can't be wrong kind of thing. Yeah. If that many people find a real appeal in this, there must be something to it. And so I've always been something of a fan of these larger firms.
Okay, excellent, excellent. So when did you start writing for the Herald?
I started writing 13 years ago, I think. It was something like that. And have had a weekly column ever since. I've only ever missed one, and that was because I was in hospital, so I'm sort of reasonably pleased. But I've always enjoyed doing the writing. The writing has changed and evolved over that time. But enjoyed it an awful lot.
So where to next?
Master of Wine.
Oh, that's right, you're doing your Master of Wine. Don't you find that quite dangerous. You know, you're a respected wine writer. Well, a wine writer.
I'm not a respected wine writer. I am just a wine writer, yes.
You're a wine writer. Master of Wine's a lot of people fail. How will you deal with that if you do fail?
Well, yes, let's get it down on paper here, or at least on tape. I may well fail this. And I kind of went out with that view. I mean, this is an enormous challenge, and far more people, I think, fail than go and pass. And I love that statistic, you know, that more people have been in space than have passed the Master of Wine. I think it's a wonderful one. In the end, it is a thing that I don't think that anybody should set out doing it with the intention of going and impressing anybody else. It's a little bit like climbing Everest. You do it because it's there and because you are sort of driven. And interestingly, when I started, I interviewed a whole series of MWs, and they almost universally had this slightly freakish kind of on the spectrum thing about going and doing exams. They mostly enjoyed challenging themselves to do weird stuff. I remember, I think two of them discovered that they'd passed whilst they were on marathon training camps, which would seem to me the bizarrest kind of thing. You've finished one challenge, right, let's go and do this next one, which is going and ruining my body, now I've ruined my mind. To anybody who was out there thinking about doing it, I mean, it's all very well for me to say this because, of course, I've not taken the exams and then failed horribly and ended up sitting in a sort of hovel weeping. But I would recommend doing it because you meet the most fantastic group of people. It broadens your horizons immeasurably. Your tasting experience, your ability to be objective about going and tasting wine goes through the roof. I mean, you just learn about a disciplined, systematic approach to assessing whether wines are good, bad, or indifferent, and doing it under blind conditions, which is pretty humbling when you first start out, that I think has no equal. And you end up learning lots of really weird stuff. And I think you start to have respect for parts of the business that you never imagined. I've become fascinated by bulk handling and HACCP, the sort of quality assurance systems. And these are really obscure things. I now find bottling lines the most remarkably interesting places that I would have never imagined. So you do find that you have this incredible involvement in the business. So I would say, if you've got your diploma and you're thinking, well, I'd like to go and give myself a challenge. You do need to give time to it. I think it's one of those things that you can't go and, you can't do the MW if your marriage or relationship is on the rocks. If you've got very young children, I think it's very challenging. People do, and I absolutely in awe of people who go and do it. And particularly, I've come across a couple of female MWs who've done it whilst they're either sort of pregnant or when they have very young families. And I waited till my youngest was sort of three before I got going. And I have an unbelievably understanding wife. And that really, really helps. Because, I mean, seriously, it's one of those things. It's about like having a child to pull your marriage together. It doesn't work that way. It just pulls them apart. And don't do the MW to give yourself something to do and it's a real challenge because you think that it might shore up a shaky relationship. It will absolutely kick it to touch. I did meet one MW once and he said, just don't say who I am. But I asked if his marriage had broken up because of the MW. He said, well, not entirely, but it was MW related. And I think there's a lesson in there for all of us.
I heard an interview with Jancis Robinson a wee while ago. I think it was on Grape Radio. And she was talking about the MW and the fact that one of the great saviours for her, I think she was pregnant when she was doing it, and that because she was pregnant, she couldn't swallow. And that was probably one of the great things that helped her through, is because she reckons a lot of people just fall off the wagon, so to speak.
I think there's a certain amount of that. I have come across various people who found that they became quite unwell because you taste such an enormous amount. You've got to taste through so many things that they tended to find they start to get almost allergic reactions to wine my teeth have gone to pot since I started doing it because it's just really sensitive because you're tasting often very young wines and things. Funnily enough, people do have the flip side in the exam. Fairly early on, one of the sort of masters of wine who was teaching you said, this is a great qualification because it's the only exam where if you're feeling a bit nervous at the beginning, you can have a drink, calm you down. So they said, when you're doing a pouring at the beginning, just have a bit of a slug of one of them. It'll just take the edge off and then you'll answer much better. And she said the time she passed was the one time she'd started going and having just a quick drink before she got going. Take a deep breath, sit back for 2 or 3 minutes and then get stuck into the rest of the thing. I did take a slightly conscious decision, and this may be my downfall, but when I started out, I said I would talk about doing it as a student. And I'm interested because now Harper's wonderfully is tracking people doing it. Yeah. But it was slightly one of those qualifications that you learned people were doing it when they passed, because there was a natural reluctance, I mean, entirely understandably, not to go and, preach to the world that you're going and doing this qualification, that the chances are you probably won't get through it. Yeah. And so there was a little element where when I sort of set out, Crikey, I'm no great sort of martyr or anything, but I did slightly have that sense that, well, it wouldn't hurt if one of us said, yeah, okay, I'm doing it and it's pretty tough. So I write about it probably once every 6 weeks or so in the Herald. And when people ask, well, I go and tell them, because I think I would certainly, just as a general member of the trade, love to see more people doing this. And I go out there, I met people today, and they could pass genuinely 15 times more easily than I will. But they don't want to do it because there is that reluctance and that fear, what happens if I fail?
When I did an interview with Tim Atkins, one of the things he said that was a real advantage to him was the fact he was a wine writer. So not only did he get access to the MW wines, but he had wine. As a wine writer, you know, you're swamped with wine.
Yes. You do slightly. I have a very close relationship with the parcel force man, who is French and spends the entire time berating me for not going and spending more time tasting sparkling Loire reds. Which, when it comes to the world of wine, about the most obscure thing to be really into. You do get to taste an awful lot of wine, and you do get to taste also things at very different levels. And it's interesting tasting with your MW colleague students, who often get to try one category. So you get these guys who, you know, sort of claret merchants, who get to taste brilliant clarets all the time, and are phenomenal on identifying Bordeaux vintages, you know, or Burgundy vintages. And yet, when you give them leaf framework, they're absolutely thrown. And, you know, you have to remember within the exam, I think Blue Nun came up a few years ago. There was a weird Greek wine that came in last year, and they get terribly, not even that they don't necessarily know what it is, it just slightly sort of jars people and throws them, and so you do taste throughout. As a journalist, there's one downside, which is that you have to ask quite personal questions of producers. Often you're asking people about their budgets. And I had this in Australia, and I was asking people how much they paid for water. They don't want to tell journalists, understandably. So you have to build up a very close relationship with people, and it's a real test of your diplomacy to say, okay, I'm now going to stop doing stuff that I'm going to write about. Can I ask you some questions for the Master of Wine? And then people will open up over time. But understandably, there's a reluctance to sort of say, oh, yeah, we spent X amount on going and buying in water allocations this year.
All right, Joe, I think we'll wrap it up there. Anything you'd like to...
Well, my big recommendation is that people should go to Scotland a little bit more and go and try some of the wines that are for sale there. There is a kind of vibrant culture, certainly vibrant dining culture, which we're seeing in Glasgow, which sometimes gets kind of missed away. Because even if you live in the nearest big cities in England, it's going to take you about 2 hours to get into Scotland. So go and have a visit. It does rain quite a lot, but there is some wonderful things happening up there. And don't just go to Edinburgh. I mean, they're all right-ish, mostly, but Glasgow's the place to be.
All right, Joe. Thanks very much for your time.
Cheers for listening. Joe is a bright, bubbly character with quite a few anecdotes and very amusing. Next week is the run-up to London International Wine Fair. This is one of the largest wine fairs in the UK and one of the biggest in the world. It is mainly for the trade. The most important thing to come out of it, apart from the opportunity to try lots of different wines, is a huge range of announcements on products and results that come out during the week of the International Wine Fair. One set of results coming out at the fair is the International Wine Challenge results, due out on the 20th of May at 11 a.m. You may remember I spent a bit of time down there a couple of weeks ago judging. I also did a couple of interviews from there. So next week we talk with Charles Metcalf, he's a judging chairman, and Mike Florence, the general manager, about the International Wine Challenge. But before we close up, I hope you enjoyed last week's joke. I have another one for you to see what you think. A preacher was completing a temperance sermon. With great expression, he said, "If I had all the beer in the world, I'd take it and throw it into the river." And with even greater emphasis, he said, "And if I had all the wine in the world, I'd take it and throw it into the river." And finally, he said, "And if I had all the whiskey in the world, I'd take it and throw it in the river." He sat down. The song leader then stood up cautiously, announced with a pleasant smile, "For our closing song, let us sing hymn number 365, Shall We Gather at the River." So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.